from WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington. Welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Namdi. Tom Sherwood is on assignment today. He'll make a cameo appearance by phone. Joining us in studio is our guest analyst, Arelis Hernandez. She is a reporter for The Washington Post, covering our region's politics. Arelis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thrilled to be here.
Also with us in studio is Jim Rosapep. He's a Maryland state senator. He's a Democrat representing District 21, which includes parts of Prince George's and Anne Arundel counties. Jim Rosapep, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
If you've got calls for Senator Rosapep, you can call us, or questions or comments for him, you can call us at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. You can go to our website, kojoshow.org, watch the live video stream there, or shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show. But first, we wanted to talk about why Tom Sherwood is not here today. He is on assignment. He joins us now by phone. He's on assignment because as a result of a suit by the Washington Post, the search records and other warrants for the investigation of the shadow campaign of former Mayor Vincent Gray in 2020 have been released. Those documents have been released today that were under seal before, and Tom Sherwood and others have had a chance to look at them. Tom, thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here, Kojo. Apologize for not sitting there with you.
Well, you had a lot of important stuff to do today. What stands out most about those documents that are currently being released to you?
Well, let me just say the documents have just been released within the last hour. And so the Washington reporters here at Channel 4, and I'm sure elsewhere, are going through the documents. Of the ones I've seen, these are mainly let me just fill people in. The investigation into the shadow campaign of Mayor Gray for 2010 ended formally last December. The Washington Post went into court earlier this year and said, look, if the investigation is over, we want to see the documents that would normally be made public but had been kept secret during the investigation. Those are the search warrants of what was seized at Jeffrey Thompson, the principal financier of the shadow campaign, Jeannie Clark Harris's home and businesses. And so those warrants, that's the information we're now getting. There are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of pages, but they all focus on what the FBI seized, the IRS agent seized, when they searched Jeffrey Thompson's homes and businesses and other people involved in the shadow campaign. You know, there was a big story we'll talk about in just a moment about the sex allegations surrounding Jeffrey Thompson that was in the Post and other places yesterday. But so far, looking at these documents, it just shows a great deal of money was changing hand, lots of emails, lots of personnel records that show the backbone of this shadow campaign and the legitimate businesses that those other people were involved in. But no smoking gun information about Mayor Gray or any other issue like that.
Well, you talked about the story that the Post and others carried yesterday, indicating or certainly implying, suggesting that Jeff Thompson's, well, intimate sexual life and the manner in which he conducted it, the manner in which he apparently attempted to cover some of it up, is what, in the eyes of the U.S. attorney, made him a less than credible witness. Is that correct?
Yes, but it's not less than credible. It was very difficult. Many reporters for many months have been working on the story with trying to answer the key question. Why did the prosecutors end the investigation into the shadow campaign and not indict or charge Vincent Gray? Because Jeffrey Thompson had gone into court in 2014 and pled guilty to the shadow campaign and specifically indicated, and the prosecutors indicated, that Gray, in fact, was involved in the shadow campaign. Now, Mayor Gray has always denied it. But then this case limped along and nothing happened, and then it ended. Well, now we know one of the reasons, maybe one of the principal reasons, Jeffrey Thompson's extensive private sex life involves possibly giving gifts and paying money to men with whom he had sex. There's some dispute about the ages of the people involved. That, of course, would be a crime if they were underage men. And this is a case where I reported in my own story that Bob Bennett, the lawyer for Vince Gray, went to prosecutors, and it's not clear exactly when, but Bob Bennett went to the prosecutors and said, you better look into this guy, Jeffrey Thompson's sex life, because it will cut his ability to go on the witness stand and charge my client with doing wrong because he has an extensive sex life that will undermine his credibility with any jury.
And so now, the U.S. attorney followed up on that.
Yes, I hasten to say, yes, Bob Bennett has declined comment on this. My sources are saying that's what Bob Bennett did. Yes, and the prosecutors then spent many, many months, apparently, trying to figure out whether or not they could get around or over this hurdle of the credibility of Jeffrey Thompson. And many people say, apparently, the prosecutors could not.
And apparently it was because Jeffrey Thompson was the only reliable witness they had. The Post article also indicated that Vernon Hawkins, who was allegedly the organizer of the shadow campaign, became, in the eyes of the U.S. attorney, an unreliable witness because his story changed, and according to the U.S. attorney, he seemed to suffer memory lapses.
Well, this was a band of thieves, let's be clear. I mean, they've pled guilty, so I can say that without any hesitation. The six or seven people who have pled guilty, including Jeffrey Thompson, were engaged in a wholesale corruption of politics and campaigns, not only in the district, but other places. And so, but in order for the whole case to be pulled together, if you were going to bring charges against Vince Gray, you had to have Jeffrey Thompson, the principal money man, the person who wrote the checks, provided the money. He could corroborate. They have all kinds of digital information. You know, they have emails and phone records and all that to set up the case. But Jeffrey Thompson was the principal person who would be a witness against Vince Gray. And the other people, like Vernon Hawkins and Jeannie Clark Harris and the others, would only be tangential or corroborating witnesses. They could only support what Jeffrey Thompson did. But so without Jeffrey Thompson, it was very, very difficult and apparently impossible to go forward.
And it now appears as if Jeffrey Thompson is facing probably 6 months or maybe even less than that in jail. And his former campaign driver said, well, if they had ever actually charged former Mayor Gray, I would have been able to provide significant corroborating evidence. But instead, I'm looking at 5 years in jail while Jeffrey Thompson is looking at maybe 6 months at the most.
Yes. And, you know, the outrage that many people felt was when Jeffrey Thompson pled guilty, the deal was to maybe ask for just 6 months in prison while other people were facing years. Now, one thing that is not answered by the prosecutors, it's in the Post story, was in part of mine, whether or not the prosecutors will, in fact, bring new charges of some kind of sexual misconduct against Jeffrey Thompson after, you know, Jeffrey Thompson goes into court on June 10th to plead to get his sentence for this corruption.
Yep.
After that, he could well face charges. Possibly face charges about the sexual misconduct and the paying of people, maybe gifts and monies to keep quiet. You know, that's what Denny Hastert got into trouble for. But we won't know where that is. And I want to emphasize here, I approached earlier this week before the Post story and before all of this broke, I approached the Thompson lawyers, Jeffrey Thompson lawyers, and said I have a variety of questions to ask you about all of this.
And they said, good luck with that.
And they said, we have no comment on anything. And so we've attempted to get him. Of course, no one can find Jeffrey Thompson. But that's the key thing. There are two big issues here. One is the sexual allegations that now surround this whole shadow campaign. And the other were the documents being released today. And so far, in our look at the documents, there's a lot of detail, but there's nothing I've seen in yet in about half of them.
Well, there's a third political issue, and that is whether or not this will likely have any effect on former Mayor Gray's campaign for the Ward 7 seat in the upcoming primary election in the district.
Well, I actually talked to Mayor Gray about this yesterday. Again, I was preparing for this story. The Post beat me. I hate to say it. Congratulations to them. Congratulations to them. But here's the deal. Mayor Gray says, as he said all during the investigation, I'm going to be the best mayor I can. I can't do anything about the investigation. It is what it is. Yesterday, he told me, he said, look, on December the 9th of last year, the prosecutors dropped this investigation. He was not charged. And that's passed for him, and he's moving forward. He's going to pursue the Ward 7 seat. Now, Chuck Fees,
his campaign manager,
who speaks a little more bluntly than the mayor does, said the problem is, he said, they've done surveys of Ward 7, and their surveys show that people in Ward 7 have moved beyond this. They're tired of this. And there's even a possibility that if the prosecutors come out with more shadow campaign stuff, but again, don't say anything bad about Gray, that it could help him in this race. The people in Ward 7 will say, look, the prosecutors undermined his reelection campaign for mayor. They appear to be undermining his attempt to go back into the D.C. Council. It could cut both ways. We won't know yet.
We'll find out as the race progresses, and we'll find out as more reporters like Tom Sherwood have the opportunity to look at these documents released today. And look forward to seeing you again next week, Tom.
Yes, I'll be there. Thank you very much for having me on, even if it's by telephone.
Tom Sherwood, a cameo appearance. He's our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist with the Current newspapers. Joining us in studio, Jim Rosapep, Maryland State Senator. You can start your calls for him right now, 800-433-8850. He's a Democrat representing District 21, which includes parts of Prince George's and Anne Arundel counties. And our guest analyst is Arelis Hernandez. She is a reporter for the Washington Post covering our region's politics. Let's talk Maryland politics for a second, Arelis, because early voting began in Maryland on Thursday with same-day registration. Talk a little bit about how the big Senate race is looking in Maryland right now. That pits former Congressman Chris Van Hollen against former Congresswoman Donna Edwards. What do the early returns show at this point?
Early returns, I'm not totally sure what it shows right now, but polling keeps sort of vacillating between Edwards and Van Hollen. I think our poll showed that Edwards was up a little bit, but it wasn't a statistically significant lead, whereas the new NBC4 Marist poll shows that Van Hollen has the lead. And so it's gotten much tighter as we get closer to voters, you know, casting their votes here. I think I checked in yesterday just in Prince George's, and they were looking at fairly good numbers of folks coming in and participating in this particular election.
People coming in early, Jim Rosapep, have you endorsed anyone in that race?
I have. I've endorsed Chris Van Hollen. I served with him in the Maryland House of Delegates. I think he's a terrific legislator.
But it's obviously going to be a very close race.
Absolutely.
How about the other races in Maryland? And one must say that the competition between Chris Van Hollen and Donna Edwards seems to be getting a little more spirited, if you will. Some people would say a little bit dirty.
Yeah, no, the White House actually weighed in on this particular race because of a series, well, one ad in particular that a super PAC supporting Donna Edwards put out there that seemed to mischaracterize and use President Obama's photo and words to malign or I guess mischaracterize Van Hollen's position on a deal back in 2010. He tried to get a campaign finance deal, and that deal, the NRA was exempted from it. And Edwards, this is a line Edwards has been using in candidate forums out in ads herself, that Van Hollen's willing to make deals and compromise his values to move things forward.
And the White House said cease and desist.
Basically.
Doing this. And then Van Hollen used in his ad that the White House told Donna Edwards to cease and desist.
That's right, today, which some people could say is just as a misrepresentative. What we should point out is that Obama and even Nancy Pelosi weighed in on this one, saying criticizing the Super PAC ad, but neither one sort of called out or denounced Edwards as a result of these advertisements.
We'll have to see how that goes. And then there's the race for the House in Maryland's 4th congressional district, in which several Democrats, including Joseline Pena-Melnick and Anthony Brown and Glenn Ivey, seem to be the three leading candidates in this race. Jim Rosapep, have you endorsed anyone in that race?
I have. I've endorsed Delegate Joseline Pena-Melnick. She represents the same district I do. I've worked with her very closely for 10 years. The one thing I would say, though, about this race, frankly, about the U.S. Senate race and about the 8th congressional district race, is we have a great choice of candidates. In some races for Congress, you don't have very good candidates. The problem in these races is you have a lot of good candidates.
And so you have endorsed one of those candidates.
And I've endorsed Joseline Pena-Melnick because I think she's the best. I think she works harder than anybody else. She's very progressive. And she works well with others. And so I think those are all things you need to be an effective member of Congress. And I think she has the whole package.
Arelis, how's that race shaping up?
Well, it's hard to tell with that race as well. You have Glenn Ivey, who's basically led the pack from the very beginning in terms of fundraisers. He was first to put out ads. He was first to announce that he was running for this seat. I think yesterday he put on an ad with his five boys and daughter talking and narrating an ad for him. So he's really doing the work out there. But you also have former Maryland Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown, who's just spent millions of dollars for a gubernatorial campaign, is still pretty well known throughout the district. with Jocelyn Pena Melnick. She's not as well known in southern Prince George's County, but she's done a lot of work throughout this campaign to try to get her name out here, and her lime green and blue signs are everywhere around Prince George's.
Okay, let's go to the 8th Congressional District in Maryland. Have you endorsed anyone in that place?
I have. I've endorsed my colleague, Senator Jamie Raskin, who, again, is just a terrific legislator. But again, there are a lot of great candidates in that race, but I think Jamie's the best.
What do you make of that race?
It's an interesting race with a lot of money, if not the most expensive race in the country right now. You have very well-known names.
One candidate in particular makes it so.
Yes, Mr. Trone.
Yes, David Trone.
Whose ads have been on the air since, I think, late January or early January.
Well, think of it the way he thinks of it. I have no political experience in this region. Nobody knows my name, so I've spent, $8 or $9 million of my own in order to make my name well-known, and a lot of that is clearly appearing on television ads.
Right. He's not bought. He is be a fresh face, according to him.
So there's Kathleen Matthews, the former television journalist and anchor here in the Washington area. There's Jamie Raskin, who was endorsed by Senator Rosa Pepp, who has long experience in the Maryland State Senate.
Right. Senator Raskin, long time on judicial proceedings, has overseen big bills in his time in Annapolis. You also have not as well-known candidates, Juwando and Delegate Ana Sol Gutierrez, but it's been a lot of back and forth between those candidates in the 8th.
Well, we'll have to see what happens with that. On to Senator Rosa Pepp. You and your colleagues in the Maryland General Assembly this week wrapped up your 90-day legislative session. Lawmakers wrestled over a deal that nearly pushed the session into special session. It would have given Maryland their first major income tax cut in nearly two decades, but it didn't happen. What went wrong?
Oh, I think the governor obviously would like to cut taxes, would like to talk about cutting taxes. I think all of us would rather pay lower taxes and have more services. There was a disagreement, though, between those who said tax reduction should be concentrated on middle-income people and lower-income people, and those who said they should be concentrated on high-income people. I'm in the group that said, yes, middle-class folks, yes, lower-income people need some help. But very frankly, the folks at the top of the income scale in a period where inequality has risen, they don't really need a tax cut at the high-income levels. And so that was a disagreement, and therefore the issue was not resolved this session.
Is this an issue that you covered, Ares, that you look at this, the debate that took place or the deal that was being worked out in the General Assembly and why it was not worked out?
I kind of flew in here at the end. My colleagues, Avita Wiggins and Josh Hicks, who spend most of their time in Annapolis, went through it. But I did talk to Senator Mike Miller, and it looked like there was a disagreement between sort of where along the income bracket that these tax breaks fell. Where did the Senate specifically, though, stand on these tax breaks?
Well, the Senate, over my opposition, backed more tax cuts for high-income people. And the House agreed with me that we should focus the tax cuts on middle-income and low-income people. So that's where the disagreement. It's a traditional disagreement every time we've dealt with tax policy or the time in the legislature. That's always the issue. And the Republicans want to cut taxes for the wealthy, and a few Democrats do, and most Democrats want to cut taxes for the middle class and low-income people. And that's why we have a democracy, to try to figure that out.
Invariably, when I've seen this story, it's been juxtaposed with the fact that Northrop Grumman was able to get a break in its taxes because of, I guess, its ability to provide jobs. So it makes it look to the average reader as if, hey, they couldn't do anything for poor and moderate-income people, but they could do something for a major
corporation. It doesn't just make it look that way to ordinary people. It makes it look that way to all the other businesses in the state who didn't get a tax cut. It makes it look that way to policymakers like me, who think we should be helping small business, and we did some things for small business that I'd love to talk about, and also want to help middle and low-income people. It's embarrassing, frankly, that the one big tax cut that was passed was for one big company.
I have a question about sort of the linking of the bills. That there was some effort to link the tax break bill to paid sick leave, which also did not get done this session.
Yep.
Did that doom any efforts for tax reform?
I don't think it doomed it. I think there was an effort to try to you're always trying in a legislative body to get a coalition together. You get some people want this, some people want that. Let's see if we can get people to work together. That's a good thing about democracy. And so part of the discussion was, would the Senate move forward on earned sick leave, which I'm very strongly for, and the House was very strongly for, as part of an agreement where we'd also have tax cuts for high-income people, and we just didn't come to an agreement on it.
You say the most important bill passed by the General Assembly, I presume this is what you want to talk about this year, got the least coverage. Can you talk about the Small Business Retirement Savings Program?
Absolutely. I appreciate it. We have a retirement crisis in this country. The Gallup poll says that the number one concern in finances for people is, will they be able to have enough retirement savings? More people are afraid of running out of money in retirement than are afraid of death. And their fears are justified because half the people in the country have no retirement savings. And half the people who work for private sector businesses have no opportunity to save a retirement for work. For all of us who have pensions and 401ks, we don't see that. But half of the people in the private sector don't have that. So when Secretary Clinton and Senator Sanders talk about increasing and expanding Social Security, they're right on. That's one way to deal with the retirement crisis. But the other way is states are taking the lead. And I've worked on this over 4 years. And this year, we're one of the first three states to pass a supplementary system to Social Security for private sector workers. Essentially, what it says is that companies, particularly small businesses, will have to guarantee their employees, if they have a payroll savings plan, payroll savings deduction for their own retirement, their own IRA. The surveys show that you're 18 times more likely to save for retirement if you can do it easily at work than if you have to go out and shop and deposit the checks and all that sort of thing. So what this bill does is says that the overwhelming number of private sector workers will have access to payroll deduction retirement plans, and the state will create a privately managed retirement fund for those workers who don't want to go out and choose among 12 different options. There'll be a default plan, which will be professionally managed, privately managed, low cost, and conservatively managed to make sure that just about everybody has access to retirement savings for their senior years.
In this session, lawmakers also passed what they call the landmark criminal justice reform bill. What were the major provisions?
The essence of it was over the last 30 years, we've overinvested in prisons and underinvested in drug treatment. That's the simple version of it. And as a result, we got too many people in prison, and we got too many people with drug problems, and too many people getting out of prison who aren't ready to get back into the mainstream economy. So essentially what the legislation does is called justice reinvestment. It essentially says, let's reduce some of the minimum sentences for nonviolent offenses. Let's divert people who would otherwise be going to jail for nonviolent offenses into basically drug treatment and other help that they need, or mental health help that they need. Put the money there. At the same time, keep the prisons focused on the violent offenders who we do need to keep in prison.
How does the governor feel about that?
Very supportive. This is an area where the administration and the leadership in both houses work very closely. It's very bipartisan.
And the governor, at this point, is very popular. What's been the relationship between the Democratic lawmakers and the governor in general?
I think substantively it's been better than it has been atmospherically. I think the governor has an unfortunate tendency to gratuitously irritate people. Irritating, legislative leaders isn't that hard to begin with. So there's been a lot of sort of back and forth. But it hasn't really had that much impact on policy, in the sense that the governor understands the Democrats have veto-proof majorities in both houses. So we've overridden a whole bunch of his vetoes. So then he started letting bills he didn't like go into effect without signing or vetoing them, which was smart on his part. So in real life, I think the major policy initiatives now are coming from the legislature, as we talked about with retirement security, justice reinvestment, climate change. We passed a very important climate change bill this year to increase our target to 40% reduction in greenhouse gases by 2030. That's a big deal, part of the whole international effort. And the governor cooperated, and the Department of Environment cooperated on that. So I think really what you're seeing is, I look at the Hogan administration look a little bit like the Eisenhower administration. The Eisenhower administration didn't try to repeal the New Deal. They consolidated the New Deal. They didn't move forward the way President Kennedy and President Johnson did after the Eisenhower administration. But Eisenhower didn't go to war with the New Deal, and that's what's happening. I see Hogan as basically being supportive or getting out of the way of consolidating the progress we made over the last 8 or 9 years.
But it would appear that since you assert that the Democrats have veto-proof majorities in both houses, what else can he do besides irritate you if he wants to gain some traction? I mean, he can't seem to be cooperating with you on everything, not distinguish himself as a Republican in any way.
No, I get it. He's got a political problem. I'm not being critical of him. He has a political problem. I mean, a good example is actually retirement security. We worked very closely with the Republicans in the Senate, and the retirement security plan, which is, it'll basically almost double people's retirement incomes over Social Security. All Senate Republicans voted for it. Unanimous. It got over to the House, and the Republicans overwhelmingly voted against it. We don't know whether the governor's going to sign it or not. He's going to have to decide whether he's going to go with the bipartisan Republicans in the Senate or go with the very partisan Republicans in the House. That's his political problem. I can't give him good advice on it.
Our guest is Jim Rosapep. He's a Maryland state senator. He's a Democrat representing District 21. Our guest analyst is Aurelis Hernandez. She's a reporter for The Washington Post covering our region's politics. Any questions for Senator Rosapep?
Well, there was one mini war, right? And that was County Executive Rashard Baker and Governor Larry Hogan over the hospital, right? There was even some tit-for-tat on the last day of session where Baker came out earlier in the day and basically said that Hogan was missing in action, right? And later, I think Hogan sort of rebutted and was like, well, they should just say thank you. And it was over that $15 million that they wanted for.
Right, right.
And that resulted in policy change, right? Has that sort of back and forth between County Executive Richard Baker and Governor Hogan had any kind of effect on the delegation itself?
No. I think this is the reality. This is a perfect example. There's a lot of tit-for-tat stuff with no policy import. Because in point of fact, because it was clear that there was a tit-for-tat, we passed legislation mandating the money for the Prince George's Hospital, for Laurel Hospital. We got $8 million more for Laurel Hospital. So the governor let that, I can't remember whether he vetoed it or didn't veto, but in any case, it became law. So you could say the governor is absent without leave. You could also say he pretty much has just gotten out of the way, which is fine because the leadership in the legislature is more than capable of setting policy for the state.
We got an email from Steve in Mount Rainier. As a diehard Democrat, will Maryland ever create natural and representative legislative districts? Can the legislature allow a nonpartisan and no politicians group to draw the next legislative districts? That requires a yes or no answer.
No, yes. Ahead, yes. I think yes. Are we capable of doing it? Yes. Is it hard to do? Yes. And it's the difference between the congressional district and the legislative district. Our legislative districts actually are much more cohesive and much less artistically challenging than our congressional districts because our state constitution requires some cohesion in the districts. The congressional districts are not required to be that way.
The governor says that Democrats outnumber Republicans in the state 2-1, yet the congressional district division is a 7-1 division because of, as you pointed out, these artfully drawn districts.
I think that's true to some extent. I wouldn't say it's not true to some extent. But it's also true that we have a very strong Democratic Party. We have very strong Democratic candidates. We're talking about these races like in the 8th District. These are real quality people. And so you got to give the candidate some credit for it. I think the bigger issue on the congressional districts, it's a national problem for sure. Nationally, Republicans are grossly overrepresented in the House of Representatives compared to their vote. And that's because Republican legislatures have drawn the lines to benefit themselves. So you really need a national solution. And I think we can get to a national solution. And we, the Democrats in the legislature, are very supportive of that.
Prince George's County became the first in the state to ban fracking outright this week. How do you feel about the move, and is there any discussion about fracking at the state level?
Well, definitely. I mean, we've worked on fracking over the last several years. We currently have a 2-year moratorium on fracking in the state. There are a lot of concerns about fracking, which are totally understandable. I think the challenge is that there are two big issues with fracking. One is the environmental effects of doing it. You're putting into the ground a lot of dangerous chemicals. They come back up. You don't want them coming up in your kitchen. Secondly, in Oklahoma, they've had problems with earthquakes related to fracking because when you start mucking around with Mother Earth and you shake her up too much, she can shake back. So those kinds of issues are really important in terms of regulation, moratoriums, banning. The other issue, though, is that, as we all know, fracking for oil and gas, not in Maryland, has had dramatic increase in the international energy market, brought down prices dramatically, which is good economically, but it also has been great geostrategically. We're not a foreign policy show today, but it's a big deal that the United States is much more independent of foreign oil than it was before. It's reduced the power of Saudi Arabia in the world. It's had big impacts, the fact that we have lower cost energy being produced in the United States. I'd much prefer that be low cost renewable energy than low-cost fossil fuel energy, and that's why we push so hard on pushing renewables.
We do have a question about Anne Arundel County, so before you go, I have to let you deal with Janelle in Annapolis, Maryland. Janelle, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes. Hi, Kojo. I was just wondering, the county prosecutor dropped charges against two people, one of whom was the campaign manager for Petroika in the robocall case against Patrick Armstrong. Patrick is openly gay, and there was a bathroom law that was pending, and for transgendered persons, and they implied that Patrick was in favor of sexual abuse in bathrooms by perverts. The persons who made the call said that it wasn't campaign related and that it was just satire and covered by the First Amendment. I wondered what your panel had to say about that.
Apparently, the Maryland State Prosecutor charged two Republican strategists with distributing an illegal robocall to smear that candidate. You know anything about this?
It's the first I've heard about, to tell you the truth.
And we don't know a great deal more about it either, Janelle, so Senator Rosapep does not have a position on it at this point. What is yours?
Well, I think it was a disgusting smear that was absolutely dishonest. I don't see that there's any First Amendment coverage. The fact that this person was a campaign manager for Petroika would seem, whether there was collusion with Petroika or not, it was definitely a campaign-related issue. It was despicable. Okay. And if it had an outcome, if it had an effect on the outcome of the election, I think that they should definitely look at whether or not Petroika should remain in office.
Okay. Thank you very much for your call. And Jim Rosapep, I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Jim Rosapep is a Maryland state senator. He represents District 21. He's a Democrat. District includes parts of Prince George's and Anne Arundel counties. We'll be joined very shortly by Barbara Favola. She's a Virginia state senator. She's a Democrat. And our guest analyst is Arelis Hernandez. She's a reporter for The Washington Post covering our region's politics. I don't know where you parked today, Arelis, but I had to go downtown this morning and was surprised. I shouldn't have been, but was surprised to find that I didn't have to pay for parking because today is a holiday in the District of Columbia. It is Emancipation Day in the district. 154 years since legislation freed District of Columbia slaves on April 16, 1862, more than 8 months before President Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation. And Mayor Muriel Bowser and others were out celebrating that day today. Joining us now in studio is Barbara Favola. She's a Virginia state senator. She's a Democrat. Senator Favola, thank you so much for joining us.
Kojo, it's a pleasure to be here, as always.
If you have questions or comments for Barbara Favola, you can go to our website, kojoshow.org, watch the live video stream, ask a question or make a comment, or call us at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org or send us a tweet at Kojo Show. Earlier this week, Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe made a last-minute amendment to a bill that would have made the electric chair the default execution method. It would keep the names of the pharmacies and drug companies making lethal injection drugs private. Was that, in your view, a necessary compromise, or is it a blow to transparency in a judicial process that, you know, ultimately involves the taking of a human life?
Kojo, that's a great question. I actually think this is one area the government should be very transparent in. I mean, we are taking a person's life. It's the most severe action a government can do. I don't frankly think that this amendment helps the issue at all. I do give the governor credit, though. He said if his amendment does not pass, that the electrocution will not be used, and essentially the death penalty will be in hiatus during his term.
I thought, and the remainder of his term. My understanding was, in fact, a misunderstanding, that in the event that a lethal injection was not available, that the death penalty inmate did not have a choice, that he or she would therefore, usually he would be electrocuted.
Well, what the governor is saying, the background to all this is the state's having a very difficult time actually acquiring these lethal drugs. And the governor was trying to maintain the option by saying, okay, we'll ensure that the compound and the name of the drug manufacturer will not be made public. So therefore, it should be easier for us to acquire the lethal drug, and the person on death row would still have a choice. But we don't think that's the right path to go. Some of us don't think that's the right path to go down. And there are a lot of constitutional questions about that. I mean, again, this is a function of government, and we would be withholding very key information. It probably would not withstand a constitutional test. I don't know that for sure. But I will just tell you, having the electric chair has the default. In other words, if the governor's amendment doesn't pass, they can't get lethal drugs, the electric chair becomes the default. That doesn't really meet the test of our Constitution either. Many state Supreme Courts, particularly in the South, have ruled the electric chair is cruel and unusual punishment. So,
well, let's talk about the legislative session that just wrapped up in Richmond. Governor McAuliffe vetoed more bills in a session than any governor since, I think, Jim Gilmore back in 1998. What's the atmosphere been like in this General Assembly session?
Well, that says it all. The governor, unfortunately, actually had good reason to veto the bills he vetoed. We made progress in some very important areas, you know, education, transportation, a little bit of progress in gun safety. But there were a slew of bills in the whole, you know, sort of social area that simply were way out of line with mainstream Virginia. Yeah, I mean, for example, we had a bill that essentially would have said that parents could look at the reading lists of their children in some of the advanced placement classes and be able to veto, if you will, which books the teacher could use or not use, simply because there was a concern over salacious material. Well,
they didn't call it salacious. They called it sexually explicit.
They called it sexually explicit. Correct. Okay. What is sexually explicit?
They call it the Beloved Bill.
The book Beloved by Toni Morrison, a Pulitzer Prize winning author. And it was a fascinating conversation on the floor of the Senate because one of the books that, you know, many, many folks in the far, far right who were pushing for this and, you know, trying to somehow ensure purity and monitor the written word actually rely pretty heavily on the Bible as their favorite book. So we were able to quote some passages from the Bible that certainly were sexually explicit and make the point, would you like to outlaw the Bible if the Bible were to be used in a classroom? So, come on. We have to talk about things in context. You know, authors need to be free to express themselves. There are a number of classical books that we've all read that, you know, may have had some sexually explicit material in it. But certainly going down the path that they went down in terms of having, parents with veto authority over these books was just not the right thing.
Well, there was a point that was made that part of the partisanship in the General Assembly in this session was driven in some measure by the fact that there's a presidential election coming up.
Well, I think that's right. I think, you know, there's always some posturing. There's certainly certain members of the Senate were the state chairs for the various Republican candidates. And there was always there seemed to be an effort to make a statement, to really, you know, play to the Tea Party faction. And frankly, even lawmakers who knew better went ahead and did that because they knew the governor would veto the bill. So they sort of had the best of both worlds. You need to
hang on to their base while at the same time
not doing any harm.
Okay.
That's right, because you need 2/3 vote to override a veto, and that wasn't going to happen in an evenly divided Senate.
Aurelis, do you have any questions for Barbara Favola?
Well, I wanted to know how much of what the Republicans in the General Assembly were pushing had to do with their own sort of Republican national agenda, and not just in opposing President Obama or Planned Parenthood or whatnot. How many of these bills did you see come across that speak to that agenda?
Well, we saw a fair number of Republican bills in the education area that were really intended in many ways to undermine public education, to undermine the funding for public education, and to really take the path down for example, giving state the authority to approve charter schools without having state money to fund the schools. And right now, there is a statute on the books which allows local school boards to make that determination. And the fact is local school boards are funding the charter schools, so they can establish some requirements, et cetera, et cetera. There were some bills to basically take that power away, give it to the state under the auspice of we're going to make it easier for there to be a more of a proliferation of charter schools. So there were some – there are always these issues that come up that sort of get to either a tax and spend difference or sort of an undermining of some public institutions that actually work quite well. So we had to fight back some of those bills. We did make some progress in key areas, though. You know, transportation, we cut a deal on I-66, which will help many of your listeners. You know, there'll be an additional lane.
Several additional lanes.
Inside the Beltway from where the Dulles Toll Road hits I-66, heading east, is going to
be
an additional
tolls.
Lane. Well, the tolls are coming in. But if you can legally use I-66, a two-person vehicle, you won't be paying tolls until 2020, and then you have to get to a three-person vehicle. And we do offer the option of an individual who today cannot use 66 without paying a penalty, that individual would be able to use I-66, paying a toll, a dynamic toll starting in 2017. So we think we made headway because, again, they're getting that lane, that extra lane.
Back to the
east.
Death penalty. Here's Eric in Manassas, Virginia. Eric, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello, Kojo. Hey, I was listening to your show, and I was wondering, have the Republicans in the Virginia legislature ever actually read the Constitution?
Oh, this is not about the death penalty. This is about parents and books. Go ahead. Go ahead, please, Eric.
Like
finish your comment.
Oh, I'm sorry. What I meant was that, the book thing where parents are supposed to approve Toni Morrison. I mean, for crying out loud, am I the only one that thinks that's absolutely not?
Apparently not.
No, you're not the only one who thinks that's nuts. The governor did veto that bill. We had a robust conversation on the floor of the Senate. This is an example of a bill where I think, you know, many Republicans were trying to make a statement. This is one of those brochure type bills. And under the auspice of more parental control, which they think is a value that should be taken to the extreme, they supported this bill. And the fact is, you know, the world doesn't operate in black and white. And one of our important principles of our Constitution, you know, the freedom of expression and the freedom of the press, and certainly to allow authors to have that freedom and to pretend that our 17-year-old children are not, mature enough to read a book that may have some sexually explicit information in it, and then have the opportunity to discuss that with an adult in a classroom to learn multiple lessons from a book, to me, just seemed ludicrous. But I guess you hit the nail on the head. There are some people who are living in a different world.
Thank you very much for your call. Here's the one on execution. It was really a tweet that we got from someone who says, hiding the drug makers for fear of retaliation seems to be indirect admission that state-sanctioned murder is still murder. Care to comment on that, Barbara Favola?
Well, I did make a comment earlier that I think we need to be transparent in this area. The death penalty, I did support a resolution in the Senate that would have called for a full evaluation of the death penalty, how it is applied, the complete process. You know, it does concern me that we have, overly represented African Americans on the death row. We have, individuals that, some would say would be mentally challenged on death row. And we need to really look at how we're applying this. This is a very, very, very serious thing that the state does, and we should be, if we're going to do it, we should be darn sure that we are doing it in a way that absolutely we, you know, we have DNA evidence, we're doing it humanely, or we should not be doing it at all. And I mean, I think we need to have that conversation.
Arellis?
I have some questions about the gun compromise where fellow Democrats stand on the deal that essentially Governor McAuliffe made with the Republicans on reciprocity and whatnot. How are you guys feeling about that deal?
Well, you know,
the compromise gun law.
Overall, it was not a bad deal. Was I totally happy? No, I was not. But neither was the other side. So we probably ended up in the best place possible. We did make progress in the areas of protective
orders. I should
tell
our listeners the deal, according to the Washington Post, would expand the rights of concealed carry handgun permit holders in Virginia and around the country in exchange for tighter restrictions on domestic abusers and voluntary background checks at gun shows. Please continue.
Yes, that's it, Kojo. We were able to cut this deal because Attorney General Herring actually said that Virginia was not going to honor concealed weapon permits that were issued by states who had lower standards in issuing them than the Virginia did. So he made that interpretation. The NRA was wildly, wildly annoyed by it. So they were willing to come to the table. And the deal we cut was we were able to take firearms away from folks under if they were under a protective order as a result of domestic violence, or my bill, which took a firearm away from anybody with a protective order if that protective order was violated. So we got those bills through. And the other benefit we got was there's going to be voluntary background checks at these gun shows. So state police will be available. They'll be around. And if a gun dealer chooses to send his prospective customer over to a state police officer for a check, then that will happen.
But it's voluntary.
It
right?
is voluntary. And that is one of the things that I think some of the gun safety activists felt we should have perhaps gotten we should have closed that loophole altogether. We could not. So, this is the most progress I have seen on gun safety in Virginia in the last 5 years. Now, my colleagues have been working on this for 20 years, and they would say it's the most they've seen in 20 years. So we have to sort of work with what we have. And I do think that we should be proud of the progress that we made.
The outcome for State Supreme Court Justice Jane Roush, who was nominated by Governor McAuliffe and served for 8 months before Republicans in the General Assembly refused to confirm her appointment, first time in 100 years. What was going on there politically?
Well, that was not one of our finer moments. Governor McAuliffe spoke with the Republican chair of the House Courts of Justice Committee. Apparently, he did not speak with the speaker soon enough or early enough in the process. And what happened was she was not approved simply because the majority party had enough votes to not permit her to continue. It was ridiculous. It was a power play. Very, very disconcerting. I don't think the highest court in the state should be politicized. And that's what this was. There wasn't one lawmaker who said publicly or privately that Justice Roush was not qualified. So it was very disappointing. And I hope that we do not do this again.
Another point, 1 in 7 Virginians live in Northern Virginia, and yet this region is not represented on the state Supreme Court at all.
No, and she was from Northern Virginia.
Yep.
Yeah, and a very qualified woman. I think she would have been the third woman on the Supreme Court. So that was, it was very, to have somebody who was qualified and so widely acknowledged has been brilliant, great temperament, just what we need on the Supreme Court, widely acknowledged by numerous groups, to not be able to make her appointment permanent, like I said, was just pure politics.
Back to schools and sexually explicit books. Here's Karen in Ellicott City, Maryland.
Hi, Kojo. How are you?
I'm well.
Long-time listener, always a fan.
Thank you.
My son is in middle school, and I want to play a little bit of a devil's advocate. I know the Republicans were kind of, I want to say, grandstanding and creating an issue, but I'm not convinced it's completely an issue of censorship. And for me, it's an issue as a parent. They read some pretty intense books. I mean, and as a parent, we aren't given a list of the books. I have to track down from the school board the list of books that he was given.
Okay, we only have about a minute left, so allow me to have Barbara Favola respond, because you obviously are concerned. You would like to be able to get a list of the books that your middle school child is reading.
I will say to the caller, first, I appreciate the question. It's always good to have a little devil's advocate in here. I, too, am a parent. I cared about what my child was reading. But my issue was I always asked what the educational benefit was of the book. And if there was a larger story there with a, you know, different multiple moral principles you could deduct from the book, if it was going to be discussed in the context, in a much broader context, I think we have to allow our educators some latitude in that.
Thank you for your call, Barbara Favola. Thank you for joining us. Barbara Favola is a Virginia State Senator. She's a Democrat. Aurelis Hernandez, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kojo.
Aurelis was our guest analyst today. She's a reporter for the Washington Post covering our region's politics. That's it for the show today. But before we go, remember we've got more for you online. Visit kojoshow.org/blog, where you can hear an interview with Jarrett Hendricks. He's a local photographer who recently worked with Instagram, the Congressional Black Caucus, and the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation on the hashtag MakeYourMap project to highlight important sites in D.C.'s black history. And remember, whatever your schedule, you can catch up with the show by streaming past broadcasts through our archives at kojoshow.org or by downloading the show podcast at iTunes to listen on your own schedule. But if you can, be sure to meet us back here Monday at noon. Metro General Manager Paul Wiedefel will be in studio for the full hour. Don't delay. Send your questions for him now. Tweet at Kojo Show with them or send them to kojo@wamu.org. That's coming up Monday at noon. Until then, enjoy the weekend. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Namdi.
The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingalisa Schroepsdorf, Taylor Burney, Ruth Tam, Elizabeth Weinstein, Avery Kleiman, and Raynell Cooper. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.
Thanks for listening to the Kojo Namdi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.